Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here, and this time it is with
me, Matt Ward Aegis.
Matt Ward Aegis. Typically, this is when Gabe Borud would pop in and say, Gabe.
Gabe.
Or no, he would say, Casey. And Gabe.
And
it's
Gabe.
Always like, and Gabe.
And Gabe.
Yeah. Real quickly, but he's not here. The backdrop to that, he had a really minor operation. He'll tell you more about it. It's just taken a little longer to recover from than he'd expected. He's fine. Doing well. But in the meantime, we thought we'd pull you in, Matt, and have you join the show. You've been on the show before.
I have, yes. You guys have welcomed me into this place.
This sacred...
To just talk about, I don't know, whatever I'm doing at any given point in time at work, yeah.
So welcome, welcome back. Thank you for stepping in. And Matt, maybe just real quick, because I don't think we've ever given you the full introduction. Who are you in a sentence, if that's possible?
I am a journalist in DW's science desk, at DW Science Desk. And I'm from Australia, as my accent either does or does not give away.
Oh, we were just talking to our technician about that. He said he thought maybe, but wasn't sure.
Yeah, it's not the classic Aussie twang, mate. It's a little bit more muted than that.
Real quickly here, Matt, we're sitting right now in a studio, an audio studio.
Yes.
And the question I have for you is do you know where I'm at, or like what I'm feeling, what I'm thinking about right now?
Well, I know you're an American, so I have absolutely no idea.
No, but I'm talking obviously physically I'm here.
Yes.
But where am I? Where, like, how do I feel emotionally? Do you have a vague sense of what I'm thinking about or experiencing?
Probably not. I mean, I did see you with your head in your hands at one point earlier today before we came in here, but I think you were just really concentrating on the things that you were reading in front of you.
On this paper that
I
have right
here. Yeah. Okay, right, there you go. Well, no. Yeah. So I don't know what your emotional state is at present, I suppose, is what you're asking me, is that?
Yeah, that is the question. Yeah. But the fact that you could even surmise that or have a guess, or that you looked at me earlier and were trying to figure out where it's going, because I think you didn't see that I was researching this here, means that you possess what is called the theory of mind. The theory of mind, it's not a uniquely human ability. It's the idea that I can look at you based on what I know about you and be like, I think I know what he's thinking about.
Yeah, okay.
I think I know where he's at emotionally. Mm-hmm. That is something that seems so obvious to us that we don't need to discuss it, but it is rare. Some animals can do it. Ravens can do it. Dogs can do it. Chimpanzees can do it. We can do it. Why?
Science Unscripted.
I'm Rodrigo Braga. I'm an assistant professor of neurology at Northwestern's Feinberg School of Medicine. I do research on the human brain and how it's organized, and we've just published a paper in Science Advances led by a student of mine, Danisa Edmonds, and in collaboration with lots of other neuroscientists.
What was the primary conclusion of that paper, Rodrigo?
The primary conclusion was that the areas of the brain that we use for thinking about other people, which are actually in brain areas that are expanded in humans, in the human brain, those brain regions share a connection to the amygdala, which is quite an ancient structure that we know is involved in all kinds of emotional processes. So that link had not been seen before, at least not in the way that we showed it.
You say that it's an ancient structure. How is the amygdala any more or less, I suppose, ancient than any other part of the brain in this context?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So yeah, in essence, every brain region is similarly ancient because it's been evolving for the same time period. But what we mean by that is if you look at common ancestors with different animals, we can estimate at what point, how many millions of years ago, a common ancestor actually existed. And so for things like chimpanzees, then the common ancestor is relatively recent, like 8 to 6 million years ago. But for something like a lizard, it's something like 300 million years ago. And so we know that the amygdala has been around since about that time.
Let's jump into your experiment here. You took what, 8 people and put them in an fMRI, and I've been in those before. There's not much to do in there. There's not much to look at. What did you? What happened to the participants in the study? They got prompted with something. When I was going through the paper, I believe it was called a false belief task, right? Because you've got to force them to engage in the theory of mind, but there's no one around. Can you explain real quick what the false belief thought process is or activity is?
So it's an experiment where you're reading short stories and then you're asked to answer questions. So we did two versions. One is an emotional pain task. You basically read a short story about a protagonist. Say, Jeff was getting out of his car, and as he got out, he slammed the door on his finger. So that's a physically painful thing that you can read about. And so we asked them, how much pain was Jeff feeling after this event? And the participants would rate between one and four. So that's a physical pain, but if you compare that with an emotional pain, that might be a story, for instance, you know, Sally hadn't seen her family dog for many years, and she was coming home to finally meet the dog, but then she found out the dog was run over.
Oh, no.
That's an emotionally right. It's sad.
Years.
What we do to
years. And right, she's years. Right about to get home, and then the dog gets. This is horrible.
Exactly. It was what a tragedy. So that's a very emotionally painful thing. And so we ask participants to rate how much emotional pain is Sally under. And so if you compare that, the physical pain with the emotional pain, when you're thinking about Sally's emotional pain, you get activity throughout this broader network of regions that we call the social cognitive network.
Okay, I've come out of the tube. This study's been published. What does this do for me as a layperson, as a person not involved in this study? What is the benefit that this has to me? I suppose scientifically, how does this help people in your field, in adjacent fields? I don't know. Understand more about how humans interact. What's the outcome that you can derive from being able to analyze these functional responses that people are having to these, as Connor very well put, horrific scenarios that no one would want to encounter in their day-to-day life?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. So I'm a what we call a basic neuroscientist. I care about knowledge, and I find it fascinating that humans are we're so good at thinking, and we spend so much time thinking, and we think about the future, we think about past things that happened. One of the things we spend a lot of time thinking about is other people, and what is that person feeling? How should I tell this person this thing? What will they respond? How they respond? And so I'm interested in how is it that the brain supports these different types of thought? And what our research does is it gives us a nice explanation, or, you know, part of an explanation as to why specific parts of the brain seem to allow us to think about others. And the link to the amygdala is very interesting, because the amygdala is this emotion processing and detection center. And so the fact that you have these brain regions that are communicating constantly with the amygdala, it gives us an answer to why those particular brain regions are involved. One thing that's exciting is that those brain regions, the social cognitive network, are in parts of the brain that have expanded, you know, tremendously in the human brain in very recent evolution. And so we think of those as recently evolved. Maybe they're doing some advanced cognitive functions. But actually, the functions of those regions, our work is showing, they're in constant communication with the amygdala, which is a more ancient structure. And so that puts it in perspective that even the more advanced cognitive functions that we think we can do, they're still relying on this very ancient machinery. I find that fascinating personally.
One thing that kind of, I was going to say depresses me, that's an exaggeration, but the amygdala and the things you've been looking at, and the network of brain activity, neural activity, it's really deep inside there, right? Like, if the comparison I usually see is your brain is like, if you take both your hands and ball them up to fists and touch them together, that's about the size of the brain, and somewhere like deep in there, that's where this thing is. So if you've got a problem with it, or if I have no theory of mind, I have no idea what this person across from me is thinking or doing, or the opposite, it's like dialed up way too high, and I'm just constantly fretting, worrying about whether this person is thinking this, that, or the other, or likes me or not, or did I say something stupid? Is there anything that you can imagine in Rodrigo, in 10, 20 years, a way of targeting this area or this network as a therapy? Or is that just completely out of the question?
Well, I mean, it's a very interesting idea. And, that sounds wonderful, being able to modulate the amygdala. The One thing I need to say is that we didn't actually study anxiety or social anxiety or overthinking in particular. And the good way to think about it is this. If you're prone to overthinking, you may overthink about many things, not just other people, right? You may, you know, think about what you have to do. You may make multiple lists and worry about those. The brain network we were studying is specifically used for thinking about others and what's in other people's minds. So the only link is really, if you're prone to overthinking, this is one of the things that you may be overthinking about. But yes, absolutely. Knowledge of brain circuits is really important because you can modulate one brain region and have downstream effects in other parts of the network. And so because our work is showing this connection between the amygdala and parts of the brain that are more easier to access, they're larger and they're on the cortical surface, which is closer to the scalp. Potentially, yes, you could apply stimulation to those network regions and have a downstream effect in the amygdala. Now, again, we didn't do this, but it's speculation that that's a potential avenue for future research.
How would you?
How would you modulate those regions?
Yeah.
Well, there's something called TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, where you place a magnet on the scalp and it basically applies a high-frequency electromagnetic pulse, and that has been shown to alter brain activity. You know, you can see this if you position it over the motor cortex, someone will jerk their hand or wherever you're targeting. If you're targeting the hand region, they may jerk their hand. But you can also apply it to other regions. And so you could theoretically apply it to this social cognitive network and see whether that has any beneficial effects.
And that was Rodrigo Braga talking to us there. He's an assistant professor of neurology at the Feinberg School of Medicine at Northwestern University in the U.S.
You know that magnetic stimulation that he was talking about, the TMS thing?
Using waves to massage the amygdala in your brain or whatever.
Yeah. And you put it on your scalp. So I've had that.
Four?
I've actually had that done to me at university when I was a poor university student living in Australia. And you get $30 per hour, I think, maybe, to sit in a chair helping a PhD student out with their study. And in my case, I volunteered to get $30 to have someone zap my brain.
You undersold yourself. $30 was the going rate?
I think it was about $30, yeah.
Per hour. To have waves, magnetic waves, stimulate regions of your brain.
Yes.
To see what happened with you.
So I'm just sitting there with the PhD researcher getting the magnet and moving it across my scalp. And I mean that very much, you know, it would move, it felt like millimeters at a time. And you would hear this crack, like an electric whip kind of sound. I can't like clapping. And most of the time I'd just be sitting there like, this is so boring, nothing's happening. And then all of a sudden she'd move it again and my hand's flying around.
Really?
Yeah. So, and my arm just goes up.
One arm? Yeah, probably
yeah,
one arm.
Yeah.
Obviously, and your hemisphere, two hemispheres of your brain.
Yeah.
Right?
And I'm just like, what the hell's happening? What is it? Wow. And then she'd move it again a little bit more and it's not flying my arm out. It's just a twitch and it's completely involuntary. And I'm thinking, wow.
Spooky.
I don't know what's going on.
Spooky.
Here, but it is spooky.
I mean, like a different version of the doctor hitting your knee.
Yeah,
with that,
very much, very much like that. And now I'm questioning, I just did this for the cash.
Yeah. How did
it
change me?
To my brain?
Did it melt any parts of you?
Like, who knows what happened? Know. Well, some people that know me would probably argue that it did do that.
No,
but,
it most certainly did not. And that's why this is an approved therapy in many countries around the world. And super, that's, for me, that's the biggest takeaway of this research and of that conversation is that it's possible, right? What I find most interesting is that it's a scale. Mm. Most of us have this theory of mind ability because of the way our amygdala, this almond-sized thing, or there are two of them in both sides of our brains, the way it interacts with the rest of our brain. We can do this to some extent. We might be very good, might not be very good. We might not be able to do it at all. That is a huge disadvantage. I'd never thought about that before. How weird to live in a world if no one could do that. Mm. I can only judge your actions, and I have no idea what your intentions or thoughts or emotional state. That's bizarre. Mm. Or on the other hand, you can have extreme social anxiety. Again, that's not what they were looking at here. Mm. And you can constantly be, you know, thinking about too much about what other people are thinking of me, and did I say the right thing at the right time? And maybe with these therapies in the future, 10 or 20 years, 30, who knows? But it's nice to imagine that there might be a therapy for that.
If required, yeah. Because I think at the end of the day, whilst it wasn't about overthinking per se, the extent of the application seems like it could be helpful for people like that. But at the end of the day as well, it's do you even need it? But it's good to understand how it works.
I think I might need it because I'm still really upset about Sally.
Yeah, that was...
I'm really upset about it. I have a dog.
That was a real curveball when he said, oh, and then we did this.
Well, it was enough for her to like be away from the dog for 3 years. Mm. They didn't need to run it over. I've seen that movie before. Mm. You don't have to do it. She could have gotten back and like warmly embraced the dog, and then I would have still been imagining her in that emotional state. Mm. That was wild. That was a curveball. Do you have anything to say about the theory of mind? Are you one of those people who goes home after a big social event and hits the replay button and maybe even the slow motion button and reanalyzes everything? Do you have that? Would you like to dial it down? Do you think it helps you? Do you have anything to say on this? Let us know, SHU@dw.com.